Baruchim Anim Sa'im, ladies. Welcome. We are very privileged that we are able to study a few minutes of Torah at a time during the week that most people are not studying. That's the reason why I chose specifically this most inconvenient time to make a class. People have been telling me for years, it's the most inconvenient time of the week, 11:30 on a Friday, even though the days are long, but mentally people have to prepare, physically people have to prepare. The other days are so long, why don't you make it another day? And my answer is that he had no tenet, that precisely for that reason. Hakamim tell us that whenever you find a time that there is a lax in the study of Torah, so you should capitalize on it, and you'll be the one that studies Torah, and you get credit for everybody. Even the yeshivas, this time on Friday, the boys close their books and they have the day off. So if we're not going to study at this time, who are we going to rely on? So we have a very good, very great purpose. We come to this class not only to learn and to study, but we're fulfilling a great service for our community, that we're keeping the light burning. And when everybody else is closing the book, we're just beginning to open it. So that's why I'm planning on making this class at 3:30 in the afternoon on Fridays. In any event, let's try to keep it at 11:30. Anyway, I'd just like to make one point on the parasha, which I think is very, very significant. The parasha is Parashat Shelach Lecha. We've spoken about this parasha a lot. Yesterday we gave a big drasha in Brooklyn to the ladies, so they shouldn't feel left out. But this morning we gave another drasha to the men. However, I'd like to say now a third interpretation regarding our parasha. It might be the most important of the three. You know the story of our parasha, it's the story of the spies. Moshe Rabbeinu dispatches 12 spies, 12 men. They were great men. And they were told to go to Eretz Yisrael and to come back with a report. These men, again, were the leaders of the tribes. So the Pasuk says, Kulam Anashim, they were men of stature. They were tzaddikim. The Gemara says that at the time that they actually went, they were kosher people, they were kesherim. And then, when they went to Eretz Yisrael, at some point, they went sour. And they come back after 40 days, and they give a malignant report about the land. And they say that there's giants there, and they live in these fortified cities, and there's people, God forbid, dying all over the place. Everywhere we went, there's funerals. There must be a virus, anti-vaxxers. They don't vaccinate themselves, these people, and everybody's dying from the plagues. And the people were spinned into a tizzy, and there was chaos. And everybody started to cry, and everybody started to say, "What are we doing? Let's go back to Egypt. Moshe Rabbeinu, what did you bring us over here for? We don't want to go to this land over here. It's a death trap." And then Yehoshua and Caleb were two of the 12 spies. And Caleb right away got up and said, "What are you talking about? It's true what they said. It might be a fierce nation, but God is with us. And we'll be able to overcome them. Alon na'ale. Yashem itanu, God is with us." And he tried to rally the people, not to listen to the spies. But it was too late already. The people were so influenced by the report that they could not have their minds changed. To the extent that they wanted to stone Yehoshua and Caleb. They wanted to stone the good men to death. And God, obviously, was very, very angry. And he vowed to destroy the people. That's how angry he was. Just as angry as he was after the golden calf. And then Moshe Rabbeinu interceded. and then the decree was not absolved, they did not get forgiven. They got forgiven from the big punishment of total obliteration, but they did suffer a big punishment. Whoever was in that generation would die over the next 40 years. The spies themselves died a miserable death, which I'll talk about tomorrow morning. And Klal Yisrael, forever and ever, until our day, would now have to look forward to Tisha B'Av, which is the day that the spies came back. We'd always have to look forward to that day now as a, you know, a tumultuous day, as a calamitous day. Destruction of the temples, beginning of world wars, etc. So that's the basic story of the parasha. It's the story of spies. Now, there is another story that's not so well known unless you study the prophets, and that is the story of the two spies that Yehoshua ben Nun sent into the land after the 40 years when they entered the land of Israel with Yehoshua. So one of the first things I guess they have to do that now. That's okay. The shoe's empty for 11 and a half months a year. And this they have to do now when finally we have 10 people sitting in the shoe. They decide to change a light bulb. Okay. It's our luck. Anyway, so he makes it louder on purpose. Yeah, I think we should. I don't know where it's coming from. It doesn't bother you, but it bothers me. Alan, we're giving the ladies, because it sounds like there's a helicopter landing on the roof. Well, wherever it is it coming from our synagogue? Is it possible that they could delay this construction until after the class? It's quite annoying. Okay, fine. Okay, right. Okay. Okay, in any event, so Yehoshua ben Nun comes into the land. It's going to start again, don't worry. Yehoshua ben Nun comes into the land, and the first thing he does is that, I'm not a prophet, and he sends spies. Could you believe it? After the debacle of these spies, you'd think the last thing he would do is to send more spies. You know, we're still recovering from the first set of spies, and Yehoshua can't wait to send a second expedition. And this time he didn't send 12, he only sent 2. The Torah tells us who he sent. He sent Caleb, who was a veteran. He was from the first group. He was actually one of the good spies. Well, Yehoshua couldn't send himself because he was the leader. He had to stay back at home. But he commissioned another tzaddik by the name of Pinhas. And they went, and actually their mission was very successful. They came back and they gave some reports to the people, and actually the people's morale was lifted from what they were told. They came back and said, the land is ours, the people are scared in their pants, they're shaking, they're nervous. We're listening to the sentiment, and everybody's nervous that the Jewish people are going to come in and just wipe them out. So it's, you know, wherever we went, everybody's predicting that the Jewish people are going to come in and, you know, destroy and oust us from the land. So the people said, oh, good, they're scared. We have God with us and so on. And it lifted their morale to a great, great level. So the question is, what was the key difference between the spies that Moshe sent that failed miserably and the spies that Yehoshua sent that succeeded? It's important to know this, because as we're going to see in a moment, you're saying to yourselves, why does the Torah spend so much time telling us about this story anyway? I mean, it's a dramatic story, but
The Torah is not a storybook. You remember when you were young and they used to read you a story before you went to sleep, and at the end of this book it says the moral of the story is, in the Torah it's the same thing. Every story has to have a moral behind it. Otherwise, you're just telling me episodes and you're just keeping me, you're stringing me on every week with another story. It has to teach me something. The word Torah comes from the word Moreh. Moreh is an instructor. So the Torah is a book of instruction. It's not a book of stories. So these episodes are to teach us something. So what do these stories teach us about messengers that went and failed and succeeded? And the lesson is going to be to us is that everybody is actually on a mission. We are all not spies, but we are all shilihim. We are all messengers. We are messengers of God. Initially, our neshamot were by the kisei kavod, and at a certain point in history, God dispatches the neshama from the kisei kavod when He decides that it's the right time. And only God knows. Even a doctor of fertility cannot predict when the child is going to be born. Could you believe that? They could send men to the moon, and they could do all these type of amazing feats. But the doctor has no idea when the child is going to come out. Because God has exactly the moment when the child must emerge, based on the time, based on the place, based on the moment. And every person that's born is given a mission. He's charged with a mission. You have to know that. So you are all on a mission. Some of you are saying, what's my mission? You see, in the case of Moshe, at least they knew their mission. They were told to go to the land of Israel and come back with a report. Yeshua also told them what their mission was. Well, I'm going to tell you how to figure out what your purpose is and why you came to this world. It's a big secret, but I'm going to let you know in a moment. But more important is that now that you know that everybody has a purpose. If you didn't have a purpose, you wouldn't be here. HaKadosh Baruch Hu needs every single person. And there's no extra people in the world. Especially there's no extra Jews. If you're here, that means God needs you to accomplish something that only you can accomplish. If somebody else would be able to accomplish what you can accomplish, so then He wouldn't need you in the world. He'd leave you in the Shamayim. Why bring you down? It's important to know that everybody lives for a meaning. Everybody lives for a direction. Everybody has a job to do. Fortunate is the person that knows his job. Fortunate is the person that executes his job and succeeds. But this is a fact. As a matter of fact, there was a rabbi called Rav Zushia. And they asked Rav Zushia once, Rabbi, would you, if you had the opportunity to be Avraham Abinu, would you take that opportunity? What would I answer? I would say in one second, I could be Avraham Abinu. Well, Rav Zushia answered back, but then who would be me? You hear what he answered? Then who would be me? Which means God needs Rav Zushia and God needs Avraham Abinu. So just to switch, to be Avraham, if God made me, He needs me to be me. He doesn't need me to be Avraham Abinu. We have an Avraham Abinu already. He did His purpose. God created me because besides Avraham, you need Rav Zushia. So why not be myself? That's an important lesson. I tell that to a lot of young guys. They come to me, and young rabbis, and they want advice in, you know, how to be a rabbi, how to, you know, give shiurim, how to give classes. And I offer them advice. And the first advice that I give them is, don't copy me. We have a Rabbi Eli already. We don't need another one. Which a lot of them, they listen and they just mimic. So what do you want to be a copycat for? Because you heard the rabbi talk like this, so therefore you're going to copy? Hashem created you because you have your own way. Yitzhak Avinu was the son of Avraham. But guess what? He wasn't a copycatter. His father was known for chesed. You know, Yitzhak was known for the other side of the spectrum. He was known as strict, not in a bad way. And then Yaakov Avinu, he chose yet a different path, somewhere in the middle. Why didn't they just copy each other? Because each one was born with their own strengths, with their own potential, with their own drives, with their own tendencies, and therefore they developed what they were. It's not just a mitzvah to be a copycat, to wear a costume and to act like somebody else. This is very, very symptomatic of youngsters, that they just copy what they see, and therefore they don't develop themselves. The electrician has to be an electrician, the plumber has to be a plumber, and the mailman has to deliver the mail. But if everybody just copies each other, everybody's doing the same thing, so the world will not be able to exist. You know, if you go to a concert, not everybody can be playing the violin. You need even that fellow in the back that has a triangle, and he has a little metal stick, and you only hear him once every 20 minutes. The camera goes on him, and he goes, bing, and that's it, and you won't see him for 20 minutes. But guess what? He's needed at the concert. So he's in the music somewhere. And without him, the symphony is not perfect. Now, who's more important? The first concertmaster, the violinist, or the bell? I don't know who's more important. If you're at that moment when you're dinging that bell, you're the most important person in the world at that moment. The violinist cannot do what you're doing. So therefore, everybody's important and very important based on what they are given a job to do. So why am I telling you this? Because we're going to have to figure out where the spies of Moshe went wrong and where the spies of Yeshua went right. Because that'll help us in our own mission in life. Well, in the case of Moshe's spies, Hakamim tell us that it was probably ego and arrogance that got in the way. You see, when they went, they knew exactly what their purpose was. Their purpose was to come back and give the people a boost, give them a good morale, because anyway, God promised them that they're going to go into the land. That already was decided. However, when they got the job, sometimes when you get a position, it gets to your head. And then all of a sudden, you start to take yourself too serious, more than you should. Well, that's what happened to the spies, because now they come back and they say, well, we don't think it's a good idea that we should go in. But that wasn't your purpose. We didn't send you as judges. That wasn't your mission statement. The mission statement didn't say, come back and give us a report if we should do it or not. The mission statement was, just tell us what's going on over there. But we didn't ask you for your opinion. This was not over here a judgment that was needed by the spies. But guess what? They became a little arrogant, and now they felt, oh, it's up to us to decide if the mission will succeed or not. No. We're going forward. We just asked you to tell us, should we go from the north? Should we go from the south? Should we take this route? Should we take that route? Nobody asked you your opinion to scrub the mission. So they went off course. Well, that already brought them to a great punishment. Because God says, I brought you to this world for a mission. Once already you're not fulfilling your mission anymore, you decided to do something else that you weren't commissioned to do, I don't need you here anymore. On the contrary, you're destructive. When somebody does something that he wasn't commissioned to do in the world, he begins to ruin the world. Because that's not what he was cut out to do. You know, again, in my example, you know, if the plumber puts on a white coat and he puts a stethoscope around his neck and he starts to do brain surgery, so you're a plumber. What are you doing in the guy's brain? There's no pipes in there. Well, you say, well, what's the difference? Well, you're destroying the world. And I guess if a brain surgeon is in the bathroom trying to fix under the sink, he's also going to destroy the world. So the doctor has to be a doctor, and the plumber has to be a plumber. But over here, these people were given a certain job, and they denied their job. They assumed a different position. Instead of the position of scouts, they assumed the position of judges. And God said, I didn't make you a judge. I asked you to be a judge. I didn't ask you if it's a good idea or not a good idea. That's a judge makes that decision. You were not commissioned as judges. So part of succeeding in your mission is humility. Humility is you do the job that God gave you to do, not the job that you want to do. You know, do what you're told to do, not do as you want. You know, I'm sure, you know, many people have certain jobs that it takes a lot of energy. And nobody wants to exert themselves more than they have to. The human being always wants to take the road with least resistance. So then already you're not doing what you were told to do. You're taking the easy road. God says, I didn't bring you here for that road. You chose an easy way out. What are you doing here? As a matter of fact, now your job's not getting done. So the world now is being neglected by this purpose. It's missing a piece now. The puzzle is missing a piece. The concert now is incomplete because you're not willing to do what you're supposed to do, because you're trying to do what somebody else is doing, or you're not doing anything at all, which is also neglectful. So that's what happened to the spies of Moshe. Now let's go to the spies of Yehoshua. And I read you a midrash. The midrash is in this week's parasha. Listen to an unbelievable, gorgeous language. And it's a midrash Tanhuma. Aleph, right in the beginning. שלח לך אנשים שאין לך חביב לפני הקדוש ברוך הוא כשליח מצווה. There's nobody more beloved to הקדוש ברוך הוא than somebody that's on a mission to do a mitzvah. שהוא משתלח לעשות מצווה, that he knows he's sent to do a certain mitzvah, ונותן נפשו, and he sacrifices himself כדי שיצליח בשליחותו. The Midrash says God loves somebody that not only knows what his purpose is, but he's committed to fulfill that objective at all costs, even if it entails great mesirut nefesh and self-sacrifice. Borei Olam loves these people. En lecha haviv. There's nobody that is more beloved to Kadosh Baruch Hu than a person that's driven, that lives with purpose, and he's willing to sacrifice even the pleasures and the luxuries and even his life in order to fulfill that purpose. And if you want to know the paradigm example of people that knew their purpose and sacrificed, the two spies that Yehoshua ben Nun sent. The second group, the two spies. Umi hayu? Who are those two spies? Shanu rabotenu, Elu Pinhas veKalev. Now Pinhas, you know Pinhas, the famous Pinhas, we're going to learn about him in a few weeks. The one that he took the dagger and he killed the ones that were committing the Avira. And Kalev is, like I said, the veteran spy. והלכו ונתנו נפשם והצליחו בשליחותם. And they sacrificed themselves. Now, literally they sacrificed themselves, because if you know the story, what happened, they came into the land, and immediately they were caught. They had good, passport control in Canaan in those days. So right away, two people infiltrated, they knew exactly where they were. They were hiding out in a house of Rahav Azonah. And all of a sudden, the CIA, or whatever you call Scotland Yard, they knock on the door, and they say, hey, we hear that there's two spies that came in from the land, they infiltrated, and we hear they're in the neighborhood. And this is like the Nazis, God forbid, coming to look for Jews in the house of the Goyim. And they said, Yehoshua was hiding on the roof, and Pinhas was there. So Rahab tells Pinhas, you better go on the roof and hide with Yehoshua. He says, no, I don't have to. He said, you're not scared? He says, listen, I'm Eliyahu HaNavi. Pinhas is like Eliyahu HaNavi. And I'm an angel, so I have a switch. I can just go invisible. I can go rogue. And he puts the button, and all of a sudden, where is he? Abracadabra, he's gone. So that's what he did. He made himself invisible. And Rahab says, I never saw people like this. They just turned themselves into thin air. And when the goyim came into the place, Yehoshua was on the roof and he made himself invisible. And Rahab said, well, there's nobody over here. And then she sends them on a wild goose chase. Maybe they went over there, and she sends them in a different direction. And then they had to climb out the window. So they put their life in danger. What do they need this for? What do they need this for? God says, you know how much I love these people? I sent them on a mission. It was a dangerous mission. They didn't bail out. They didn't say, they didn't come back to Yeshua and say, listen, we went 2 miles and we got scared and we said, you know, it's like a soldier in the army. Imagine the soldier gets in front of the enemy, gets scared, and he turns around. And the general says, what happened? I don't know what happened. I got scared. I came back home. What do you mean you came back home? Now they're going to take over the border. So God says, I love somebody that has a purpose and he doesn't back off from his purpose at all costs. But now listen to what the Midrash says. The Pasuk says that they were sent. Vayishlach Yehoshua Shnayim Meragelim Heresh Lemor. He sent them Heresh. What does Heresh mean? Quiet. He sent them on a clandestine mission. Well, that's obvious. He's going to send spies. They're not going to have a sign that says we are spies from a foreign land and broadcast it on a, you know, on a megaphone. Now, why would that pasuk have to tell me that he sent them Heresh Lemor? Anybody that's involved in espionage knows that the number one rule is has to be Heresh, has to be on the quiet. So they can get in under the radar. So comes the Midrash and says, don't read the word Heresh. Move the dot of the sheen to the left and read it Heres. You know what Heres means? Heres means pottery. So he sent them as pottery. What are you talking about? As much as I don't like the first interpretation, this interpretation is worse. So the Midrash goes on to say, Melamed sha'asu atzman kadarin. You know what a kadar is? A potter. Not Harry Potter. A potter is somebody who sells pottery. So they dressed up like pottery salesmen. I don't know what they wear, pottery salesmen. Maybe a cap, maybe like overalls. And they come in and they have a bunch of, junk pottery. Little vessels, little plates, little, apparatus that they're selling. And it says they went through the land. Vayusufhim, they were screaming, Kederot, kol mi sherotze yavo v'yikneh. Who wants to buy pottery? So this is a trick. Nobody suspected that these, measly pottery salesmen are actually involved in James Bond. They're involved in a mission, a spy mission. So he says, "V'kol kach lama? Why did they do this? Shelo yergish bahem adam. So nobody will recognize them. Lachen ketiv heresh karibe heres. Kedesh shelo yemru bnei adam meragelim. So nobody will think that they're meragelim. Very nice. Can I ask you a question? That was the only costume they had in the costume store? I mean, if you're going to go dress up on Purim, there's many costumes. Why did they decide to become pottery salesmen? I know some of you are saying, that's what they chose. What's the difference, Rabbi? No. These are tzaddikim over here. Everything that they do and everything that they choose is for a purpose. So why did they choose to be pottery salesmen? Why didn't they sell Coca-Cola? Why didn't they sell, widgets, buttons? Why don't they sell potato chips? No, we're selling pottery. Kadarim, Heres. I once saw brought down from the Sfarim in something incredible. That the pottery represents why they succeeded. You see, let me tell you a law that applies to vessels. This law doesn't apply today, but in the olden days it was very, very popular, this law. You know that there used to be a law that says that if somebody is ritually impure and they touch a vessel, the vessel becomes impure. Could you imagine that? Forget about having to dip your vessels in the mikveh when you buy them. You'd be happy to go to the mikveh every week dipping vessels that you had dipped already, but now that they became ritually impure because somebody impure touched it, somebody came back from a funeral and picked up the cups, that cup is no good now, we can't use that cup, it's tameh, put it on the side. And then a lady became tameh, nida, she picked up the cup, forgot that was nida, put that on the side. So you had a whole bunch of vessels that will become tameh. Today it doesn't apply anymore, so we got we got off that law. But in the olden days, vessels would always be have to become, you know, pure. Now, let me tell you a law in this laws of tum'ah. A metal vessel, metal a pot or a pan, it becomes tameh. It can receive impurity by touching the outside of the vessel. Now you learned something. Congratulations. If you touch the outside of a metal vessel, it becomes tameh. However, an earthenware vessel can only become tameh from the inside. Could you imagine that? If somebody touches the outside of an earthenware vessel, it does not become tameh. Only if the tum'ah enters the airspace on the inside. If you have a minute, I can explain to you why that's so. We judge a vessel on two ways. There's two ways that we characterize a vessel. Number one, its worth. Every vessel has worth, intrinsic worth. And then we judge it on its function, on its usage. So you see, a metal vessel has intrinsic value. It's metal. Metal is expensive. And it also has function, the way you use it. So impurity is able to affect the important part of the vessel. So in a vessel that's metal, even the outside is susceptible, because the outside has value. The outside is intrinsic. So tum'ah is able to affect it. Whereas an earthenware vessel has no value. It's cheap, it's junk, it's earth. The outside of the vessel is worthless. The only value of a earthenware vessel is the inside. That's where the function is. So that's why an earthenware vessel can only receive tum'ah in its purpose. Its purpose is what's inside, to carry things. Is that difficult? It's not difficult. Now we apply this to the spies. You see, when a person has a mission, one must remember a human being is like an earthenware vessel. You know, all of us are made out of earth. Please don't get offended. But if you break us down to our lowest common denominator, we're made out of earth. God took earth from the temple when he created Adam, and he added some water, and he formed like a, you know, it was like a dough. He made a dough. The ingredients of the dough was earth and water, and he shaped it, and he made the first animal cookie. That's the human being. And then we take on a form of flesh and blood, but ultimately it's earthen. So every human being is an earthenware vessel. One always has to remember, our value is not on the outside. On the outside, that is external. The value of a human being is on the inside. That's his purpose, what he came to this world to do. And therefore, the spies that Moshe sent, they forgot about their internal purpose. Ego affected them, and therefore they forgot that they don't have intrinsic value. They thought that they have value. They thought that they were like a metal vessel that has intrinsic value, and therefore they got lost on their purpose. Whereas the spies that Yehoshua sent, they were like earthenware vessels, that this, to them they did not exist. They believe that they have no purpose. Their only purpose is on the inside. That's the purpose that God sent them to fulfill. No ego. No matter what it takes. It's not about us. It's about getting the job done. It's not about whether it's easy for us, or whether it's comfortable for us, or whether we have to make a sack. We are nothing. We don't exist. We're like an earthenware vessel. That's why they chose to sell earthenware vessels, to remind themselves that it's not about us. It's about what's imbued inside of us. That's our purpose. And for that, we're willing to risk our lives. Heres lemor, that costume that they chose was to motivate them not to lose the purpose, so the ego of the external will not affect them. An earthenware vessel only has its value from the inside. Well, if that's the case, you see something else. an observation. You know, the 12 spies that Moshe sent, the Torah lists us their names. We know all their names. The Torah tells us their names. Well, I told you the names of the two spies that Yehoshua sent. But you know, the Nabi doesn't tell us their names. The Nabi just says, "Vayishlach Yehoshua shnayim meragilim." He sent two spies. The Nabi doesn't even tell us their names because the spies that Yehoshua sent were totally effaced. They had no self. They had no. It wasn't about them. They did not interfere with their mission. They did not let themselves interfere, or their ego or their arrogance cause their mission to be, God forbid, a compromise. They forgot to mention their names, and that's a praise for them. Doesn't matter what their names were. The main thing is that they succeeded. Now, this is a great, great lesson in life. In 1961, the president was President Kennedy. I wasn't born at the time. But I read history about it. And Kennedy made a speech. It was such an inspiring speech that a few months later on Purim, the Lubavitcher Rebbe actually quoted President Kennedy in his speech. Well, let's say what Kennedy said first. He got up and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to announce today the forming of a new organization. And that is the Peace Corps." And he explained to the world, what is the Peace Corps? He said, "You know, America is a blessed country, and we have a lot of, you know, talented people in agriculture, doctors, science, etc. And there are a lot of other countries that do not have the know-how that we have. So we've enlisted 1,000 volunteers," he says. "Volunteers, people that are not going to get paid, but they're willing to go to these far-off countries and live with the people, eat what they eat, live the way they live, and take their potential and their God-given gifts and share it with the people of that country. And it's going to be a great sacrifice because they're not getting paid to do this, but they'll make a great difference on these communities that will rely on them. And it's definitely," he said, "living with purpose. These people are motivated because they're going to, you know, make a difference in the world." And that was, he announced the peace corps. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe gets up a few months later and says, "You believe it? I've been talking about this idea to my students for years and nobody's listening. I've been saying it, that as Jews we have to have our own peace corps. There's Jews living all over the world and they don't have the same luxuries that we have in Brooklyn over here, and wherever he was, in Crown Heights, with the kosher meat and the kosher bread and all the, you know, shuls and mikvaot. So what should we do? Just let those Jewish people that don't even know that they're Jewish, and they don't even know that they have a problem. They don't even know that they're lacking anything. That's the biggest problem. They don't even know that they're lacking anything. What should we do? If the United States government can send Peace Corps in order to help a third world country plant tomatoes, don't you think we should have our own Peace Corps to send people out from our area over here?" He says, "But the people over here hear me say this over and over again, and they come to me with excuses." And the Rebbe was all agitated. "Excuses? Don't they know that this is their purpose? Don't they know that God gives everybody a mission? And they come along and give excuses why they don't want to leave Crown Heights, why they want to be next to the Rebbe, why they want to have kosher." He says, "But what's going to be with all these?" He says, "A messenger has to be willing to sacrifice for his purpose." He said, and he was a Rebbe. He said, "I'm telling you what your purpose." He was a rabbi who could tell you what your purpose was. They would come to him and say, "You go to this North Carolina, and you go to the Far East, and you go to Europe." He would tell each one of his students. He would send them on a purpose. He understood that you have to have a reason in life. And actually, he would call all these people that he would dispatch throughout the world, Shiluhim. Shiluhim means messengers, not his messengers. Messengers as ambassadors to spread the word of God. And he would say, you're not going to have an easy time where you go. He says, over here you have a luxury, in his language, you could shower in the morning and you could shower in the afternoon. But in the places that I'm going to send you, you might not have that luxury. These are third world countries. But if that's your purpose, you have to be willing to sacrifice for the purpose. And you're going to go to a place where there's no yeshivas and there's no mikvaot, and you're going to have to figure it out, and you're going to have to figure out how to get the kosher food. But in order to benefit the people that are there. And he would say that the Midrash writes, "En lecha habib lifnei kadosh baruch hu kishaliach mitzvah." There's nobody that God loves more than somebody that's committed to a shlichut. Anyway, many years later, I was invited to the dinner where they gather all the 5,000 shluchim from all over the world. So he said, I had once been invited in, I think it was Montreal, the Chabad. They inaugurated a new Chabad, and they invited me to speak. Rabbi Raskin in the Chabad in Montreal. A very, very nice fellow. And that they didn't know that I have an affection for what these people do. But when I got up and I spoke, I said, I have a very, very big admiration for what you do. That, you know, you go all around the world and you help Jews and you take care of these people that nobody would take care of. It's very, very impressive. Although there's no reason for them to come to our community. We don't need any help. Let them go somewhere else. So I don't know why they have to come on top of our heads over here. But that's another story. I mean, our community is the last community that needs kosher food and needs restaurant and needs... but that's another story. But in Venice, you need them, I guess. But not in Deal, New Jersey. Not in Brooklyn, Ocean Park, wherever you ask. You don't need a Chabad. What do you need them for? We're self-sufficient. I'm not too sure what exactly. Maybe there's people that snuck under the radar, so they need to take care. They don't need to take care of us. One should not leave their community's customs to go somewhere else. You have your own customs, you have your own tradition. That's good for people that got lost under the rug, so they're able to, you know, scoop them up and give them a life. Anyway, that's a side point. I didn't come here to criticize. I came to compliment them. In any event, when I got up, I said, I have there's a big debate if there's life on other planets. It's an old debate. I said, but I'd like to settle that debate here tonight, and I have a conclusive proof that there is no life on other planets. And the place was silent. And then he asked me, how do I know? I said, because if there was life, Chabad would have been there already. So the fact that Chabad is not on Mars, you can rest assured there are no people living on Mars. And that's to their credit. Anyway, so they saw that I have an affection for this type of business, so they invited me to their dinner. The dinner was in Brooklyn. They invited 5,000 shlichim to a warehouse. Actually, the chief rabbi of Israel was the guest speaker, Rabbi Amar, and they put me on the front table to be with all the, you know, to get a good good look at what's going on. It was a very inspiring night. So they have one of these messengers that get up and speak, and he tells his story. And he gets up and he says, the Rebbe sent me, you know, 35 years ago to, some far off remote place in the middle of America. You know, nobody there. Nobody there that knows that they're Jewish, or nobody there who knows they're Jewish is interested in being Jewish. He's there. He said, and then I came down with a disease, and I didn't feel good, and I wasn't making parnasa, and everything that can go wrong was going wrong. And I had a very, 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 very difficult time. So he said, so I came and I wrote a letter to the Rebbe. And he has the letter that he wrote to the Rebbe. And the Rebbe responded. In the letter he writes, dear Rebbe, he said, you sent me here and nothing's going right. My health is deteriorating. Parnasa I don't have. I have a difficulty with my family. And he went on and on and on, listing all the troubles that he has. And therefore, I'm asking the Rebbe to release me from my shlichut. You see how these guys are big tzaddikim. They won't release themselves. The Rebbe told them to go, so they're going to go until the Rebbe doesn't have to go anymore. Derech Eretz, please, I'm asking for a release. He says, now let me show you the Rebbe's answer. Dear Mr. So-and-so, I'm sorry to hear all of the problems that you're having. But you know that everybody comes into this world with a purpose. And everybody has a shlichut. And everybody has a mission. And clearly, as I told you, this is your mission, to be in this place at this time to serve these Jews. I am shocked, he says, the Rebbe. Why do you ask me to release you from your purpose? Ask me to release you from your troubles. Ask me to release you from your sickness. Ask you, but you cannot be released from your purpose. I cannot release you from your purpose. The purpose is who you are. That's intrinsic. That's your function. I cannot release you from that. So why do you ask to be released from your function? Ask to be released from the things that are deterring you or the inconveniences that are making your purpose difficult. Nobody should ever ask to be exempt from the reason why they came into this world. Oh, he gave him a big musar. And he says that he realized that, you know, he made a mistake. And he says, guess what? I asked the Rebbe for forgiveness, and the Rebbe blessed me. I said, I'm still there. I got better, and I had a terrible disease, an autoimmune disease, but he overcame it, and he is successful there. And that's really the purpose, which means things in life don't go easy, but that should not cause a person to bail from what he came to this world to do. Now, how do you know what you're supposed to do? That's the last point, and I'll let you go. How do you know what you're supposed to do? How do you know your purpose? Well, in the olden days, it was very easy. The Zohar HaKadosh says, you would go to the Beit HaMikdash, and in the Beit HaMikdash, the walls of the temple, the environment of the temple was so strong that it would give a person clarity. And when he would leave the temple, he'd know exactly what Hashem wants from him. Now, we don't have a place that's so sensitive to a person's goal like a Beit HaMikdash, so that's off the table. We do have rabbis today, great rabbis, like the Rebbe was, and others, even today, that are able to help a person. But the best way to find out what your tikkun, why you came to this world, what Hashem wants from you is, what are you attracted to? Everybody has strengths. Everybody has kohot. A person has to think, what am I good at? What am I drawn to? What excites me? What motivates me? What charges me? And once already starts to find things that he enjoys doing, now he has to take that God-given talent and charge and now direct it for Kadosh Baruch Hu. Some people love teaching. When I was in 8th grade and my rabbi was Acham Baruch Alav HaShalom, already in 8th grade I knew what I wanted to do more or less. I was impressed by Acham Baruch. Now, I didn't say I want to copy the rabbi. I don't copy the rabbi. Rabbi didn't talk like I talk, but he taught me a goal, a purpose. And this purpose, I enjoy teaching. And that's my passion. I love it. If somebody would tell me, you know, when I went to San Francisco once, that's a long flight from here to San Francisco, is maybe 6 hours. And when I got there, and the fellow picked me up at the airport, said, you know, Rabbi, this is San Francisco. You know, you may be used to getting 100 people to come to your lectures, but San Francisco, if we get 20 people tonight, it's you know, it'll be a big success. And sorry that we had to take you out 6 hours to come to speak to 20 people. I said, I'd come 6 hours to speak to one person. He said, oh, come on. So when I ask you a question, when a brain surgeon walks into the operating room, how many people are on the operating table? Does the surgeon come in and say, oh, only one person? I came all the way from here, the one guy. I'm going home, I'm offended. I thought there'd be 30 brains here on the table over here that I'd work on. No, one brain is enough to save. I said, give me one person. I'll talk to him till he's blue in the face, until I get him to commit to God. One person's enough if I could save one. He says, okay. We're shocked. If it's something that you enjoy, then that's got nothing to do with numbers anymore. It has nothing to do with how many people. It's just that you enjoy doing what you're doing. Now, other people, they were born to be charitable. Other people were born to have organization skills. Other people were born to do chesed. And there's no mitzvah to be somebody else either. God needs everybody's kohot. And even if it's a very specific item, there was one rabbi that he survived the Holocaust, and he decided that he has an attraction to studying the laws of Shatnez. And he studied it until he opened up Shatner's Laboratories on Lee Avenue in Williamsburg. And because of this one man, there's Shatner's labels on all our suits today. Before he came along, Shatner's didn't exist in America. This was his item. And he'll be remembered for that. Anybody have a doubt what his purpose in the world was? His purpose in the world was to bring this mitzvah back, to teach us how to check a suit for wool and linen. That's a great purpose he had. He wasn't a charitable guy, and he wasn't a learned guy. This was his thing, wool and linen. No problem, that's the purpose. He's the guy with the bell. He's more than a bell. He's the first violinist. That's a mitzvah in the Torah. But my point is that that's probably the easiest way to find out why Hashem brought you in the world. What are you drawn to? And then once you figure it out, you have to be willing to sacrifice your life for the purpose. That no matter what the conditions are, your mission is your mission. You never ask to be released from your mission. You ask to be released from the inconveniences that might deter you from your mission. But your purpose is your purpose. That's why we don't believe in ever retiring. God retires us. We don't retire ourselves. So God says, you retired yourself now. So what are you doing for the world? Unless you want to retire yourself from nonsense and commit yourself to good things, then that's a good retirement. But to retire yourself from what your purpose is, why you came into this world, to help the world, to make it a better place, God says, I'll retire you when I believe that you fulfilled your, when you got to the end of the rope. Last but not least, I mean, I think about that a lot. When I was having problems with my eyes, and I wasn't able to see, and I would dread to myself, how am I going to go give a class? I can't even see the words in the book. What am I going to sit in the class over here? And I would say, what do you mean? That's your purpose you came into this world for, to teach. So now, even though it's difficult for you under these conditions, for a year it was like that. And to come to the class, I'm seeing the words blurry. And the people in the class don't know that the words are blurry. I look at my dad, I have to try to make it out. And once in a while, they correct me. They correct me. I read the word wrong because I didn't see the word. But that's not my problem. My problem is to pray to God to relieve me from that, because I'm doing it no matter what. I have to do my job no matter what. I have to cook for Shabbat no matter what. That's my purpose as a Jewish woman. And I have to prepare the children for school no matter what. Just pray to God that I'm able to do this in an easier way. But if that's my tikkun in life, nothing's going to stop me. And everybody has to recognize that the shlichim found themselves in Yeshua's time under duress, but it didn't deter them one moment. Last but not least, on Rosh Hashanah, there's a prayer that they say in the Musaf, that God judges us on this day. Ki zecher kol hayitzur ba. On this day, zecher kol hayitzur, God remembers all His creatures. Ma'ase ish ufkudato. Ma'ase ish, God judges the deeds of man. Ufkudato. What is ufkudato? Rav Mendelevitz, alav shalom, explained, ufkudato is his purpose. God on Rosh Hashanah says, what did he do? And what is his purpose? Which means, did he live according to his potential, what I put him in this world to do? Ufkudato means tafkido. What is his tafkid? So God said, well, his tafkid is this. Now what did he do? Well, he's going in this direction. So God says, well, he's off track. He's off track. He's not helping himself. He's not helping the world. So therefore, it's quite impossible for a person to fulfill his mission. Well, I take that back. There was once somebody that, lo alenu, Bala Tashbi, passed away very young. In the times of the Gemara, this is. And the rabbis came to console the father. It's a Gemara Baba Kama, page 28. And they came to console the father and listen to the consolation. They said, well, if anything else, if your daughter was destined to do anything else, she wouldn't have died. So if she died, that means she had nothing else to do. And, you know, that doesn't sound like such a consolation. Although the person, the rabbi that was there said, thank you very much, it consoled me. What he meant to say is, listen, she fulfilled her purpose. Some people fulfill their purpose at 98 years old. Some people fulfill their purpose at 28 years old. It all depends on when God feels that you made your tikkun. He says, if your daughter needed to do anything else, she still would have been here. So be consoled that, you know, she was born 10 feet from the finish line, and she was able just to make, and some people are born 10 miles away. But she did her purpose, she was a good girl, she acted in a proper way. So rest assured, she has nothing, you have nothing to be sad about besides that you miss her, but from her standpoint, she fulfilled the tikkun in a much quicker way than others. The lesson to us is, the moral of the story of the spies is that everybody is a shaliyah, and God loves people that live with shlichut. And the shlichut has to be somewhere in the Torah, not a shlichut to go, you know, save the whales in Greenland, or go, march to save the ozone layer. Those things are important for people that don't have Torah. So they have to find some synthetic, purposes that keep them busy. But for us, we have the 613 mitzvot. We have enough options on the menu to keep us busy with something that has value. And once you figure that out, and by now, I mean, I'm looking around this class, everybody should know, more or less at this age, what you are cut out to be. I would be concerned if a 90-year-old lady would come and say, "Rabbi, what do you think my purpose is?" Now you're asking, you're 90 years old. Now you woke up. What did you do for the best 90 years? Oh, I played canasta. Now that's not your tikkun. Canasta is nobody's tikkun. That's a pastime. But what did you come to this world to do over here? To shoot golf balls? Well, that's a good thing to do once in a while. But that's not your purpose. That's a pastime. That's a relaxation. But what did you come here to do? I don't know. It's still not too late because you're still alive, but you better get it fast because you have a lot of white hairs. In any event, for us the lesson is to figure out what our shlichut is and then to commit ourselves to do it under all conditions. And then the benefit is, God says, you're the most endearing one, Haviv Takadosh Baruch Hu. But the way we do that is Hiris. To forget the outside, external part, and to remember that our function is internal. Okay, stop.